Hello and welcome the internet. I'm your host Jonathan Redding, with me as always
Philip Kelly.
And Hello. We are Advice
to the Players.
To the Players. We're coming to you for the second time, excitingly, from A Noise Within's brand new space in Pasadena.
Overlooking the wonderful stage from a balcony.
Yes, we're in a VIP recording area. Or a reappropriated recording area, but it is gorgeous in here, and hopefully I'll be able to cancel out that echo. So if you're hearing that echo, that means I couldn't fix it in post. But not to worry, and we're here with Rob Dean, Abby Creighton, and Angela Gulner, three company members of A Noise Within, and three of the players from Twelfth Night. How are you guys doing? Welcome.
Thank you, fine.
Good, thank you.
We're very excited to be talking with you guys today. Now, you played the love triangle. Rob, you played Orsino. Abby played Olivia. And Angela played Viola in the recent production of Twelfth Night, which we saw and was wonderful and we loved. I wanted to ask you just to start off, each of you, what does the title mean to you?
To me, it sets... I'm sorry.
Tic Tacs were passed around
before we
started.
So we'll see.
Celebration. Basically, what you will. It's called Twelfth Night or What You Will. It's a celebration. It was presented for the first time at Whitehall Palace in front of Queen Elizabeth on January 6th. 16. That is the legend. It doesn't turn out to be so. But that's the way a lot of people thought of it for a long time. So it was performed on Twelfth Night because she asked for it then. And that's what I always think of it. I think of it as the end of a celebratory season, and what you will. Just make of this play what you will, which, like so much of Shakespeare, is absolutely perfect. Because that little subtitle gives you a huge freedom, because Twelfth Night can be a clown show, very successfully, or it can be a very, very, very deeply felt, dangerous environment where someone is struggling for her life. And it still works on both the dramatic and the comic level. So, yeah.
I think also when Julia wanted to set it in Cuba and talking about Twelfth Night and Carnival and the idea of it being kind of a time of sort of madness and change and celebration. I think that was a big part of her when she was putting it in Cuba, or sort of that feel to it was the idea of Carnival and what that moment, that sort of couple of days of celebration that people experienced.
Angela?
I think, like Rob was saying, really clung to the or what you will part of the title, because for my character, being the outsider and coming to a new place, there's a sense of the entire play just being sort of like a ping pong ball, being just like hit back and forth and not having really any control over anything, and just sort of having to accept whatever sort of situation she finds herself in. And so that sort of was a title meant to me, I guess, throughout the process.
And Viola is supremely adaptive among Shakespeare's heroines.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting to me, and I didn't really think about this or articulate it until after the last interview, but it's interesting to me that, the setting, the Cuban setting, placed the show at a place and time, sort of at a height of excess, at a little bit of a height of criminality, almost, and there was a sense of festival to it, but there's also that foreshadowing, because, Cuba fell.
Mm-hmm.
The Malvolios of Cuba won. Ultimately, there was that uprising of the more servant class. It's interesting to me the way that kind of that suggestion permeates itself.
In the play being set in pre-revolutionary or pre-Castro Cuba is an interesting choice for many things. But one, you can't really set Twelfth Night, I think, in a world where someone, that is to say the Duke, does not have the power of life and death over other people. Or you can't play the fifth act, and therefore it won't work. He says he's going to kill her, and that's exactly what he intends to do, and everyone acquiesces in it, It is not something that seems particularly unusual. Any period in history where the leader, the jefe, the had power over people, life and death, it could be any period in China, in all of Chinese history right up till today, it could be any fascist government, and certainly the Batista regime before Castro, the local landowner basically could kill who he wanted. That's very, very, very important. For all of European medieval history, it was the same. They were not going to be held accountable for murdering people. As long as you said it in one of those times, you're okay. It would actually be okay in Castro Cuba, too. Mm-hmm. It'd be fine. It wouldn't be a carnival, but let's face it. But there, you know, as long as murderers can murder with impunity in that historical period, I think the play can be set there.
Let's talking about the Duke for a second. I've seen the show produced before. The Duke's a real prick, and I didn't think you didn't approach it from that direction. I found the Duke very likable. Do you want to talk about that for a second? What led you down that path? To kind of make him more charismatic and approachable.
You know, I've never seen him played as a mean guy.
Really?
I don't think it's in the lines.
Yeah.
I don't think it's in the lines at all. Huh. I think if anything, he's a bit on the oblivious side.
Sure.
To the concerns of people who, you know, who aren't of his class. Mm-hmm. But I do think that Viola has a long way to go. Okay? She has a lot to do. And there is not a scene where she can fall in love with me. She just announces it in the second scene, okay, that we have together. Mm-hmm. And it's a short one. She announces it to the audience at the end of it. And all I'm doing is begging her to please intercede for me. That's all I'm doing. It's not going to be believable that she would fall in love with me if I am excessively removed, certainly mean, mm-hmm. you know, certainly a prick. No one wants, you know, that it would make her job harder. It would make the audience go, huh? And so there's the conceit. Oh, okay. So let's remove ourselves from complete reality, you know. So what I wanted to do was to give it a chance. Now, but I didn't really think of that until a couple weeks in when I realized, wait a minute, there's nothing here. Except this. So I suddenly thought to myself, okay, all right, so I am the kind of guy that someone could fall in love with on sight, you know, and that did inform what I said. Yeah.
Sure. Then I guess over to you then, Angela. It's tough. It's difficult, I imagine, for Viola. I find it to be one of the more difficult characters in the show to have to pull off because of that. How did you approach that from your side coming at the Duke?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I don't know if we ever really talked about the fact that there's not a scene where they fall in love, really. But that was something that I was kind of struggling with.
Sure.
And I guess the way I sort of, because she's very, very smart, she's very, very capable, but she's also been dealt the most devastating blow of her entire life. And there's, you know, you can imagine post-traumatic stress and her body being physically hurt, and so I think like the comfort of a disguise, and the comfort of in especially in our play, like this older man that's replacing the men in her life in this form of safety and friendship. I sort of tried to cling to the like I need an ally, you know, sort of track. That's where I tried to find my way into that.
There also is an implication of this deep and immediate connection that she so quickly is vaulted into the highest levels of his confidence.
Right.
That there's a fusion that happens there,
yeah.
And she is empowered to challenge his ways of thinking,
right.
And to speak to him very directly about his own motivations, about the ways he conducts himself, about the way that he woos, to challenge his sort of pseudo-misogynist assumptions about the value and quality of a man's love versus a woman's love. You know, she is able to do those things in a very short period of time.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's plenty. Shakespeare gives us enough. I come on, Cesario, thou knowest all.
Mm-hmm.
From the first scene, if music be the food of love, play out the hell with thee, wall down. Maybe I can... and off I go. Second scene. Cesario, I've told you everything about my life. Please, help me, intercede for me. And the third scene is, oh, can we hear that song we heard last night?
It's amazing.
You know, so so you have to, that's what it is. It's just, it's like a slice. It, the connective tissue isn't there. You just have to walk right into a relationship that has grown a lot over the course of a few
very
weeks.
Short time.
Yeah. And there's absolute comfort by the time we get to the scene where I say, no, you know, women can't love like men. You know, they don't have the depth. And you say, oh yes, we do. Or, oh dear, I mean, oh yes, they do. You know, yeah.
But I also feel like Shakespeare gives a lot of weight to chemistry in all of his plays. It's like one moment, one encounter, and your whole life has changed.
Yeah.
You know, as you like it, it's like gone. I'm going to go follow him into the woods. I met him once. I mean, even the scene with she and I, it's, I mean, I have a set of circumstances that I get cracked open and this person affects me, but it's always, you know, kind of, there's a lot of assumption made, I think, in all of his plays that to me has always been, it's just chemistry. It's a feeling you can't.
You look at Kate and Petruchio. If they don't fall in love at first sight in that first scene, that's a horrible play. That's a brutal play if that doesn't happen.
Well, love at first sight is a very human thing. I think that
whether it starts with interest at first sight is even better.
Yes. Because then you don't know where it's going to go.
Let's see what happens.
Yeah.
I can. Let's see.
It's interesting to me that this is one of the things that supports my real belief in the importance of subtext, and that Shakespeare did write things with this this field of back work for actors to do, and trusting actors to go off and do it on their own is exactly this kind of relationship. And you look at something like The Decline of Lady M, you know, and going from you must leave this to you lack the nature of all seasons, sleep, to, you know, out. You know, and the hand washing scene, and this decline is something that's happening in the background, you know, of the play, and having to trust an actress to be able to go off and do that and construct that psychotic break on her own, you know, that's not explicitly laid out for the audience in depth because we're with the king, we're watching his decline.
I think the language gives you this incredible map, and then it's your job as a modern actor to fill it with everything psychologically that you can come up with to give the richness of the language its due. You know, I think that's sort of our jobs when we get, I mean, the language gives you so much, but it's, I mean, I approach it from that point of view. I got to do Lady M with Rob. He was amazing, and I got to jump in the show for a couple of weeks, and I basically worked at home alone on trying to understand the underneath. So when we met, it was bringing the language to life and having the richness of who this woman was. You know, and for me, I think that was the most subtextual of his plays, you know.
Yeah.
What, can you talk a little bit about the relationship, the backstory between Olivia and Orsino, and conceptually in terms of the Cuba setting, how do they relate to each other? I mean, is he a ruler and she's landed gentry? That's my, you know, I'm trying to balance that out in terms of the hierarchy of the governance of the realm. Clearly he is the ultimate authority within the world of the play.
Yes, I have an implicit military authority behind me.
Okay,
that's what the play, you know, says. Basically, I've been in battle. I describe battles. Okay, so I have that going for me, which puts you at the absolute top of the heap in terms of Shakespeare and every other piece of literature in the world until the 20th century. You are the leader. However, in terms of rank, royal blood, or in Batista's regime, money and land and cows, we're equal. And family history, we're equal. She's a countess. You know, I'm referred to as the count, I'm referred to as the duke. You know, I'm just sort of there. So while I am operationally on a higher level, or more powerful, we are equal in rank. It's very important that we be equal in rank. The reason that people think, oh, I just wish she would get with it, is because I'm a big deal, not because it would be an improvement in your state, you know. So that's sort of the way I think of it.
We had talked about the fact that perhaps we had grown up on this island. He had gone off to do military training or whatever, and then come back and maybe met me once. Sort of had that sort of love at first sight thing, idealized thing, and then, as I got older and of a marriageable age, it became sort of a wooing situation. I mean, I had created that we had, you know, probably had a few encounters with my father present. Then when he died, I was basically left to make the decision of whether I was going to marry him and wasn't sure. And then when my brother died, it was like, I think the grief just clarified for me that I am not in love with him and that it was not going to happen. And I didn't need him and I didn't need anybody, you know. And I think Olivia is in such a state of grief and kind of crankiness at the beginning of the play. I mean, everybody is bothering her. Everybody wants her money. Everybody, you know, then she's a woman, and setting it in a modern age gave me more of a license to be more of a feminist, to think about my situation and not so much, you know, that I need a man to you know, I think she knows that she can, if she's got Malvolio and some people assisting her, she can maybe handle this. You know, it's until I think that she falls in love and cracks open with Cesario that everything changes, and this sort of this craziness kind of comes out, you know, which I think is based on repression and grief.
Something I felt in your production, and something I see actresses struggle with working with Olivia, is there's a tendency to try to maneuver their way around this dichotomy of being grieving and then falling in love instantly and then getting into the comic hijinks and the back and forth mm-hmm. with Cesario. And there's a desire to kind of get out of that difficulty as an actor.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought it was something that was really just embraced in this production, that it turned on a dime, you know, and that's, I think, what the text implies.
I think so too.
Kind of trying to stack the deck somehow yeah. about her beginning circumstances, you know, and look at it as a show.
Yeah, I think it's grief. Grief when it flips makes you mad. I mean, I think that it's in the writing. You know, he understood that you know, it's like when you're feeling sort of depressed for a long time, and then all of a sudden you feel something else. It's just like it's like a drug. You just want that. You know, I didn't think it was an intellectual exercise in the degrees, besides the fact that, you know, it is hard to fall. For me, it's like one thing, what makes me fall in love with him? You know, that has always been the challenge for me. I got to do this play about 12 years ago, same role, and it was the same challenge. You know, what is it that makes me fall in love with Cesario? You know, and we had talked about it. Mm-hmm. It would have been fun to have done the scene with Max, who played her brother, just to see what it would have been like to do it with a guy. You know, and I had to kind of keep imagining this was a guy that I was, you know, mm-hmm. had this huge crush on or wildly attracted to. It makes you feel so much different. And we, you know, we talked about that, about especially that second wooing scene, that maybe I can't look at him, her, him. It's too intense.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but when it's a girl and she and I are in the dressing room together and we're buddies, and it's very easy to just be completely eye contact and open. But if mm-hmm. it was someone who you were feeling so many feelings for, you can't look at them that much. It's hard. So that was mm-hmm. interesting to kind of keep trying to figure that out mm-hmm. as we went along.
I'm curious, because this, you know, this love triangle emerges where you've got, you know, each of you is, you know, you have Olivia pining after Cesario, pining after Orsino. What role, if any, do you feel like projection sort of plays in that? Is speaking to that same point, you know, this series of sort of love at first sight scenes and arising maybe out of what each of them needs, arising out of this grief, arising out of the shock, you know, of this terrible storm at sea and the crashing, the drowning of your brother. I'm, and I guess you did speak to it a little bit in terms of that safety and that security, but
mm-hmm.
I always wonder, to what degree is this authentic love, to what degree is this lust, to what degree is this some need that's being projected on this other person.
In my case, it's a construct. I have built a relationship that doesn't exist, and I totally believe in it. There has been not one shred of evidence that relationship exists. She has just never loved me. She apparently has been honest about it from the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
I am pining away. Now why? What is the construct? What does it serve? Your ego. This is the first time I've ever been in love, and I don't know.
And denied.
And certainly denied. But you know, like it, that's the nice thing is to act as if, yes, I've always presumed that once you know once you were free and old enough once I was back from the battles, that you know you would of course want me. We've known each other since you were a child, and I was a middle-aged guy. You know, and it doesn't work. So I constructed it, and it's not real.
Interestingly, we're sort of mirror images. I think it's the same thing. I mean, we had so much fun with our backstage antics before we'd get on stage, mm-hmm. creating our relationship, because the narcissism of Olivia and Orsino, you know, is amazing. And it's the narcissism built on wealth and privilege and always getting what you wanted. I mean, I was the you know, the petted daughter of a father and a brother, and always got my way, and always, not that I'm not a nice, you know, not a nice person, but there's a narcissism and an entitlement. And when I decided I've fallen in love, that's it. It is love, and he must love me back because I love him. You know, there is no, there's no doubt in my mind, and it's exactly what he does. It's kind of like they should be together.
Yeah. It's true. We're from a world where the freshness of Viola is so entrancing immediately to you and subliminally to me, because I think it's a male. But then once I realize, you know, it's a gorgeous fifth act moment, yeah. You know, the speech where, oh, I see, I got it, oh, you know, yes, that's who I love. You know, it's believable, I think it is, after all we've been through.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, let's talk about that, these reversals in the last act. You have to lay the groundwork early in the show for those final moments to work. You going with the brother, mm-hmm. even though you have no idea who he is, based on your love for Cesario, right? Which is, it's a leap. It's a leap the audience has to make with you, and the actress has to find a way to make.
Well, you
to
just
make
have
well.
To think that the twins are exactly identical.
In every way. Well, not every way, but almost.
Almost
every way.
Yeah. Or else yes. She's insane.
Anatomically, things.
In that critical genital region.
Right.
There is a slight difference.
Yeah. And then even the Duke and then.
Well,
Viola,
that is less of a leap.
It
because
is less
they have a relationship that, although it was built upon a falsehood, you feel like there was a great deal of truth that managed to enter it despite that.
Well, and there was a moment that I remember specifically during the production in which you, Angela, lean your head against your shoulder, and I can't remember how it plays out exactly, if you shy away from it or what happens to wake that you up from that.
Mm-hmm.
Did you guys find that in rehearsal?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And what kind of spawned that sort of moment, which was a nice little moment.
I don't remember how that happened. Do you?
I don't. Julia kept encouraging me to go for it, and I think I wanted to. That scene was always really difficult for me because I always, I think Viola as a character is written, she's more brave than Angela tends to be, and so there is a certain amount of myself and the Givens wouldn't act in a certain, you know, trusting the leap that Shakespeare has you take. And I never wanted to send up the idea of, you know, I always wanted everything to be very genuine. But I think that, like we were saying before, there's a level of comfort with them at that point that it's not even a big thing for him to do that at that point, because they're so closely entwined as friends.
And we have just had a very intimate conversation.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Died your sister of her grief, my boy? I am all the daughters of my father's house,
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And all the brothers too. Mm-hmm. And how sad, you know, and we've had an argument about, you know, how women love versus how men love, and she stood up to me, and we're sitting there, and we're smoking, and we're alone, and I put my arm around her,
mm-hmm.
because I feel that she's been through a lot with her, you know, something, you know, that she told her sister must have died of this love, this unrequited love that she's just told me about. And then she dares to just sort of, it seemed to, I wasn't doing it, but
mm-hmm.
what it felt like to me was you just said, I'm going to rest for a minute, and you put your head on my shoulder, you know?
Yeah.
And I was just completely content with it. There was never, not a flinch, nothing, just because
mm-hmm.
we belong together.
Yeah.
And we're just sitting there, you know? And then you had the next line, which was,
yeah.
Well, shall I go back to her and ask her and tell her how much you love her again? And I there was a little pause,
yeah.
And I said, yes, let's do that. You know, and it broke it.
Yeah.
Right. There were a few lovely sort of touches and flourishes of the relationship between the two of you. I like the just some of the gentleman servant, almost butlery kind of shaving him, and the different ways that you know that you would attend him and give him your focus and the gentility that kind of came into that, or the gentleness rather. And then sort of the contrast between that and then between Olivia and Mariah, you know, who had this kind of a little more saucy, like, back and forth in this, you know, this house with these, like, kooky drunks and this chaos kind of everywhere.
Yeah, it's a weird house.
Mm-hmm. Well, in the fifth act, so you're the bathing suit that became, like, the wedding gown.
Yeah.
Where did this kind of creep in and come into play? Because this was gold.
This was all the director. This had nothing to do with me. Believe me. She said, "I think you're going to be. I've got this idea. This polka dot bathing suit." I'm like, "Okay. When are we doing this? We're in the second half. Oh, okay." And then I said, "Okay." So then I put on a wedding dress. You're just like, "I don't know." And then she goes, "A veil and a bathing suit." Oh, are you kidding? The whole second half. So I think it seemed to make sense with the sort of madness that Olivia. It was fun. It was, I think, it emphasized and punctuated the kind of wild, passionate journey that she goes on. It's like she doesn't care. It's like caution is gone. Everything. Mm-hmm. It's just there's an incredible desperate love that's happening, or lust, or.
Well, yeah, there's a very carnal undertone to the, because of the drunks and the world that it's set in. Mm-hmm. With the sort of the drums in the background and the dancers. It's very carnal. Mm-hmm. And very animalistic at times.
And very hot.
Very hot.
Just literally,
yeah.
Very,
yeah.
You feel the sweat. You've got the sense of the cane fields.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. How did that inform your guys? Just that, I guess that world, that environment, that tone the show took, how did that help you dig and inform some of those, like that carnal feeling?
Well, one thing that Julia set up early on was that the fourth wall was the ocean. So that was also really, that was helpful, I think, for all of mm-hmm. us who are on, you know, all those outdoor scenes, you know, of just mm-hmm. imagining. And I had a lot of pictures in the dressing room of just what I thought Cuba would look like, and just always that feeling of the water and the palm trees and then the sunsets or dusk or twilight or things that would sort of kind of help me get in the mood, just the look of the land, the feel of it. I looked at a lot of pictures.
The two poles of Olivia moving from this black mourning garb and surrounded by her handmaidens and the Santeria, the Obeyan kind of religious iconography and mystery and mystique, and moving from that into this kind of wild abandon of this polka dot bikini, and it really popped. So I don't know. I thought it was a kind of an inspired choice all the way around, and I get that that's something that the director brought, but I feel like you so embraced it in the performance, like.
Yeah, I am not comfortable. Well, actually, probably it was Rob. I am not comfortable doing that, and it's like it's good for me because it busts through fears or whatever. And I remember I had this with the robot, and Rob said, "Take that robot off. You know, you look great." You know, and it was for me as an actress, I have to embrace it. I have to be completely fearless, or I can't do it. You know, and I remember coming back to the show after having a couple weeks off, and I was in the bathing suit. And I went, "I feel completely naked. I'm not used to this anymore," because I kind of found a comfort level. And then I think finding the, instead of it being about like, look at me, I'm sexy, it's like, look at me, I'm sort of desperate, you know. And there was a little bit of just the need was much more than any kind of ego trip about it. It was, it was sort of the craziness took over rather than feeling like I just want to prance around. And that felt good to me. That felt like I could kind of, that's sort of, I think, how I grounded it for myself. And it was fun. I made it fun for myself.
Something I really enjoyed about this production is I felt that it was very straight up, you know, with regard to the text and just dealing with the story as it's there, as opposed to commenting upon it. You know, it became in vogue sort of in the 70s and 80s to take this play in very dark directions, following sort of the madness of Malvolio and the more subversive statements that maybe are in that. And you know, it's always been fashionable to minimalize the dark parts of the play and focus on the romp. But I thought that there was a lovely balance that you all struck as an ensemble. And part of that for me is the fact that there were these little hints and bits about the gender tension, and that particularly between Orsino and Cesario Viola, that there were these senses and moments where you feel like there's this attraction that's budding there, and it's not maybe necessarily comfortable for this very straight man. You know, what was that like for you, exploring that, looking at those questions in the text?
Well, you know, I talk about how you could so easily pass for a woman.
Yeah.
Your small pipe is as to the lady. You know, I talk about it with, and I found myself, when I was looking at her in the mirror as she's shaving me, I'm like looking up at her face, the mirror I'm holding, or she's cutting my hair, and thinking, you're like this, you know, you look like this, you look like this. And all I could see was just her face. You know, the environment wasn't there. You know, it was just her face. I'm commenting on the quality of it, how finely tuned it is, how it can pass, it can totally pass. And I then suddenly the mirror goes down, and I'm back in the world. And it was a little like, what was I just saying? I'm not particularly given to self-reflection, or not at all. I want, and I get it. But that was that. It started there, right away. And then, when we're friends and sitting there smoking cigars together, there was a real ease that I'm not used to. I'm not accustomed to being treated that way by almost anybody, but certainly not by a young man. You know what I mean? I'm totally, totally drawn to this young man. Now, in this production, I'm a lot older than Viola. Oftentimes, they're cast as pretty much the same age. So, but let's face it, this was it. So, I find myself incredibly attuned, just like, make sure a woman is like this that you love. And like, no, you don't want that. That would be too old for you, and that would be too old. And all these fabulous things. And then there's little moments of silence. And that's where it happens, is the little moments of silence where I kind of run out of things to say, and I realize how comfortable I am, and it's an unfamiliar feeling. I've seen it played where Orsino is deeply troubled by his feelings.
Yeah.
Deeply troubled. But you have to go to kind of a dark, quiet place for that to happen, and there needs to be a pause, and it needs to be staged just so, and the scene has to essentially stop. I don't want that. You don't earn pauses in Shakespeare unless they're written, you know. There may be one. You know what I mean? So you just have to keep going. So it has to happen on the lines. And that's kind of how I found my way back.
Angela, what was it like for you sort of navigating the gender dichotomy? And I don't know, Viola is this, she's sort of a magical creature in a way. She's she's the lady from the sea, like,
yeah.
Archetypally there's something.
Yeah, it was, I did this play a long time ago in undergrad before I had any sort of Shakespeare training, so it was probably atrocious, but but I remember struggling with a lot of things in it as well. And I don't know, I guess, like, I tried at a certain point to stop thinking about gender and stop thinking about, I don't know, and just sort of interact with, and just try and get done the things that I had to get done, because so much is being thrown at her constantly, and she doesn't belong here, she has no home, she's just sort of there in this world, she has no place, she has no identity, she kind of, you know, there's like a ghost sort of feel to it all, and so I just sort of tried to trust her smarts and like follow that in each situation, just trying to be true to her brain, I guess. And I started, you know, the process trying out a lot of like guy stuff, and you know, I like bound myself and like stuffed my pants and all of that. but then Jeff and Julia sort of had me take that away, and I think some of it sort of remained, but I don't know. I mean, Shakespeare writes that, you know, I'm going to dress as a eunuch, and he talks about how womanly I am. So there's not like a ton of responsibility to be a dude.
Yeah.
Because Cesario's not a dude.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, you played it very simply, and I believe that Viola is one of the great underestimated acting challenges of Shakespeare's heroines. But there is just something, there's a quality to her, like you talked about the freshness that that Viola Cesario brings, and how there is this feeling as if she is this new life in this kind of tired old world.
She's
partying and politics.
She's sane.
Hmm.
She is.
Yeah. She's, except for maybe the arguably falling in love so fast, she's sane.
And even in that, she's
not
unique.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you look at comparably another child of the sea, you know, Ferdinand in The Tempest, mm-hmm. has the exact same circumstance. Shipwreck,
mm-hmm.
believes
mm-hmm.
that his loved ones are drowned and is you know, marooned with the sounds and the music and the spirits of the island and terrified, and then falls in love with Miranda instantly, you know, on sight. But we don't seem to question that as much as artists, I think perhaps because Miranda is an equivalent, you know, because Miranda is also a magic creature. Miranda is this wildling child of the island and grew up with Caliban and Ariel and, you know, kind of comes from similar stock.
But also, she's never seen a man before.
Right, yes.
Especially except her father. And this beautiful man arrives, and she says, oh, brave new world. You know? Yeah. Here, it's different. You know, it's a little bit more.
Yeah. Yeah, I feel, I don't know, thinking about it and trying to think about the experience of working on her, I feel like there is something, like, I can't quite pin down where she lives or where it... Because she's just morphing constantly throughout the entire thing. She has to morph and put on different hats, and I think her heart is so big and her brain is so big. She just she just has to survive, but she does it positively.
Hmm.
You know, she's not a victim.
Yeah.
You know,
she's not a victim, and she's not a mockable. Like
yeah.
she, could, I feel like she could hurt these people if she wanted to. If she was of that.
Oh yeah, I mean, she has a lot of power, emotional
yeah.
power.
Well,
yeah.
I remember Julia always saying to you, don't keep her, she can't get mean. She can't get mean to Olivia. She can't get mean.
Yeah.
She has to just stay on task.
Yeah, and also, like, it became painful as the run went on. It became really painful to turn her down and to give the ring back. I felt really bad because I'm seeing this woman. I don't have any friends besides Orsino. You know, I'm seeing this woman who's feeling these things that I'm feeling, and I see, like, what... how far it's taken her, and I don't want to hurt her feelings. There's nothing wrong with her.
Can you talk a little bit about the first meeting between Olivia and Cesario, and the you know, what's going through your mind, Abby, like hearing this young man has like stationed himself like a sheriff at the door and refuses to leave? And
yeah, I've always found that scene so tricky. I mean, it's all, if you follow just the map of the language, it's bizarre. You know, so to go from the mourning and the feeling of that to all of a sudden the switch, like where does the switch happen, has always remained kind of elusive to me and strange.
Hmm.
And it is something that's not in the language. It's something that has to be there between them. And I think it's somewhere in the first quarter of the scene where I send the women, he wants to be alone with me, I send the women away, and he talks about virginity. There's something that happens where we meet eyes, or it's all those things that aren't spoken that have to start to operate for Olivia, I think, to go where she goes. And the way, when I think there's an attraction, the chemistry, and then when he talks about how he would woo, it's something profound to me. I feel like it's a soul connection, whereas Orsino doesn't even speak my name. He calls me the Countess, and that's sort of created sort of a superficial kind of love that I feel nothing. But when he speaks, something vibrates for me. And I imagine, in terms of the work as the actress, I imagined kind of a window opening and sort of a feeling of air rushing in or light after so much sort of repression and darkness and sadness. And that all of a sudden that feeling completely takes me over. It's a sort of a rush of emotion or heat. And then it's sort of a madness of love happens.
And here again, you have somebody that won't accept what you say, who's going to stay and fights against your wishes, I think,
mm-hmm.
is an interesting thing as in your case.
Yeah.
You fall in love with her. You're in love with her even though she says no. He's saying no to you constantly. And there's this, maybe this idea there that it's different and it's somebody who's standing up to me who won't go away until...
Yeah, we talked about that, mm-hmm. you know, with the directors, that there's something about him that's just so completely different. And he says the weirdest things to me. You know, he says, you're beautiful if you're really like, you know, if you, man, you know, if you did it yourself or if God made you. He says things that a man would never have said to me. So it sort of throws, I think, Olivia off balance a lot, which mm-hmm. allows other feelings to crack open. He's completely honest on a level that I think other people, especially Orsino, has never been with me, and it changes something.
It is interesting, mm-hmm. Phil, that all three of them do wind up very quickly enmeshed in passionate loves for people that are unobtainable.
Right.
Or that, you know, profess themselves to be unobtainable.
And, mm-hmm. Which I've seen just regular people do all the time.
Yeah.
It's like that's it's a very common trait in
quality. There's something alluring about the
person you can't have. Yeah.
Well, and falling in love with love, the feeling, mm-hmm. not necessarily the mm-hmm. truth of what's standing in front of you, but all of a sudden you have the feeling, so the feeling must be the truth.
Right. Yeah.
Just mm-hmm. universality.
Yeah. Yeah. Can we change the subject, please?
Coming into the... moving into the fifth act of the play, I'm just curious what it's like for the three of you when the subplot starts to erupt and intrude. That you've been doing that. You have been moving through an all-consuming story of your own, and then meanwhile, here come these worlds colliding, yeah. And it's particularly for you two. What is this parade of lunatics?
I think I just like sat down. I was like.
Well, and you have to like duel with people.
Yeah.
They actually pull you into it.
Yeah. And things just, in that fifth act, things just got too crazy. Maybe I'm insane. I don't know if I can state. This is just, there's no words, I feel like, until Sebastian arrives. I think like her mind is blank maybe for the first time. Like she's just hit it, the limit. This happened.
Right. I've been rejected. I have gone insane. I've decided to kill him. I'm marching off stage, and I find that he loves me, and then that he's married to her. That's all. None of this is real or true, but that's what I find. He's married to her. I sit down and I say. Just never talk to me again. Just never, ever talk to me again. I'm not defeated, of course, but I'm deeply angry and hurt in a way I've never understood, and the clowns show up. And what happens is the social reality is what I clung to. I stand up, and I have lines, like, oh no, Jenna, what's the matter? Like suddenly, all that's happened almost is irrelevant. And what we clung to was the social aspect of it. I stood up dead center and took a look at her. This is her household, after all. It's taking place in her house. These people are behaving like maniacs, screaming and bloody and drunk. And I look over at her. Can you please get this together? She looks embarrassed. She says, who hath made this havoc to them? Olivia does. So we clung to suddenly the social, that's all we had. Because you can't keep the thing, we can't keep the rest of it going. Then they finally get cleared out and Sebastian comes and the play goes back. It's phenomenal.
I always wondered though, and we talked about this a little bit, which was kind of interesting, that when Festi comes in, he does not acknowledge the revelation of the twins. Mm-hmm. It's like Shakespeare just forgot about it.
Yeah.
And I ever talked to Anthony about that, but I was like, you never even look and see that there's two of them and one's, I just thought that was like a weird oversight.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah,
I've seen it played that Festi knew.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
I like that. It's strange though. It's nowhere in the play in the language.
No, it's not, but his dealings with Viola or with Cesario,
yeah.
or he's so elliptical, in all of his language and his approach to everyone, and Shakespeare, you know, stepping out more and more this archetype of the prophetic kind of fool, transcendent, that would find its apotheosis in Lear, in Lear's Fool. But yeah, there is that. And then concluding with the song, which, you know, was excised in your production, but the final song that Festy sings.
Mm-hmm. There's something very prophetic about Festy.
Also, you know, he does go on at some length, now that I think about it, with Sebastian, with the brother, about how, oh, come on, you just saw me. What do you, why are you kidding me? What? And so you could, there is room in there for him to suddenly realize something's very wrong here.
Yeah.
This didn't happen in this production.
Right.
They could just, come on. What? And it was over. But this, it could descend into, what? and leave him knowing.
Mm-hmm.
He could know. He could decide. He could see it. And then start back on a road. Okay. You know, and then, but the payoff would, of course, be recognizing it in the fifth act.
Right.
You'd have to, you'd have to acknowledge it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I would say one of the biggest laughs I had during the production was when you all realize at the same time there's a second Cesare, you all turn slowly back.
Yeah.
It was a fantastically choreographed and played moment. I was in stitches.
That was particularly
nice
lovely, Abby, from you. I think there was this sudden,
like
just a whole lot of things fell into place all at one moment.
Yeah, it's a weird journey. It's almost like you have to go from like really super smart to kind of super, super blank. You know, I mean, for me, like a dumbing down kind of. It's like if you were a smart brain-oriented person, all of a sudden you became a body passion, and the brain went away, and it's just all sensation. And I feel like it's in the writing. I mean, it's just all just one. It's like I think it's just
wonderful.
Yeah, just it's wonderful.
Yeah.
Things just keep coming in. It's like the world just keeps, you know, seeping in this whole different kind of way, and it's fun. It's a very different kind of woman than it starts out with.
And why not?
And why not? And why not in a polka dot bikini? You know?
Yeah.
Yeah, that most wonderful moment. I get there was just something on your face like after that, for me as an audience member, that I felt like seeing, like, oh, that's why she rejected me. And then so I wasn't there. There was a sense that I got
of
like
relief.
I wasn't really rejected.
Yeah, like,
like I knew it. Like, there had to be something. Guys, I want to thank you so much for coming on the show. We're about out of time. I also want to just take a moment to plug, because Rob and Angela, you were both in Antony and Cleopatra, which is opening up March, early March, and you guys are in rehearsals now, and we're very excited for that, and so we want to make sure that our listeners know that that's getting ready to open up here in Pasadena at Noise Within. You can check that out at NoiseWithin, is it .com or .org?
.org.
Mm-hmm. NoiseWithin.org, and we'll have we'll post links to that as well. And Abby, you're going to be working on The Illusion a little bit later in the
second
season.
Second show in the season, yeah.
And is that, can you just briefly, because I think there are going to be, that's a lesser known play than Antony and Cleopatra, can you talk a little bit about The Illusion?
It's an adaptation of a Corneille play, and it's Tony Kushner did the adaptation, and it's really wonderful. It's classical and modern at the same time. It's a bit like a fairy tale. It's a father looking to find his son. He goes to a magician's cave, and then all of a sudden the magician conjures images of his lost son, and I play sort of the soubrette in it, and there's sort of young people, and it travels. I think the play's about love. It travels through different kinds of love that exists in a father's love for his son, and what young love and then married love and then middle-aged love is kind of about. And it's beautiful. I mean, it's a really magical play. I think it's going to be very fun to be a part of. And Casey Stengel is directing it, and I'm excited to work with her, a new director in the company. And Deborah Strang is playing the magician.
Ooh.
So that's going to be very interesting. I'll conjure. Sometimes I actually did this play also a long time ago, a different role, and it was also a woman who played the magician.
That's
cool. So I think it's going to be very cool to hear the concepts behind it, and it's going to be a lot of fun. So.
That's awesome. Is that going to be late spring, early summer?
Actually, no, it's a rep. So basically after Antony and Cleopatra open, we go into previews a couple weeks later. We sort of, everything will roll in. So the whole spring season will fishtail
Dovetail, I think it is. until the end, until May. So they
you don't want the other
one. No, you don't. Just have to be bad. Don't
be bad.
Yeah, so it's a rep. So once everything opens a few weeks later, and then everything runs at the same time.
Awesome.
Yeah.
And Rob and Angela, has it been announced? Is it something where you can tell our listeners what you're going to be playing in Antony and Cleopatra?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Sure. Yeah.
I'll be playing Octavia.
Awesome. Same sibling.
Same sibling.
So your Sebastian
is my
is
Caesar.
Octavius.
Yes.
The great universal landlord.
And I'm Ina Barbas, who is Antony's loyal lieutenant who defects and dies on stage from shame.
Oh God, that's a great role. I'm really excited for this production. I'm really excited to see it. So, well, thank you guys so much for coming out on a Sunday morning and sitting down with us from the beautiful space, new space here at The Noise Within. If you haven't seen it yet, get out to see it. It's lovely. For Rob Dean, Abby Creighton, Angela Gollner, myself, Jonathan Redding, my co-host,
Philip Kelly.
This has been Advice
to the Players.
To the Players.
Dramatic pause.